welcome back to the Comic Book Tour Guide podcast. I am your guide as usual, Jesse, who, as always, is leading my our guest, our passenger on this endless tour through comics, who doesn't know all the details, the ins and outs, the everything. And that's why they asked me to talk at them for a couple hours every so often. Ashley, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited for today's episode. I have so much to learn today. I'm just teeming with excitement.
One day I will get better at these intros because they're all, it's always a new format. But again, we have another guest guide with us, someone who will take us through the other side of the lake of some sort, the reverse side, the behind the scenes a bit. But we have another writer, another comic writer with us, coming all the way from Ireland. Thank you for staying up so late to talk to us. Gary Maloney is here to talk about his new book, When the Bud Dries, and a bunch of other stuff. When the Bud Has Dried. Excuse me. Let me correct myself.
No, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. You're not the only one who has said it like that. So I wouldn't be worried at all. But no, I'm delighted to be here and to be part of the tour guide, being part of the guest tour guides for the episode, to take you on the magical journey that is comics and the wonders it can offer. But no, I'm really, really delighted to be here, and thank you so much for having me, guys.
We're so happy that you reached out. Like, it was, I felt like as soon as our episode with David Pepos came up, you were like, hey, I listened to the episode, it was great, can I interview? And you, I went to your profile to see what book you just put out, because that's usually what I do when people ask, and I go, oh, I literally am pulling this book, so yes, of course you can come talk to us about it, because if I'm reading it, I want to talk to people about it. So I was ecstatic.
It clearly was just meant to be. It was the stars aligning, you know, the magics had just all worked out the correct way, you know. So I'm gonna say that was fate brought us together on that day.
Another happenstance of fate. I was going through the supplemental stuff you sent us, because I hadn't had time to read it yet, so I was reading it a bit today, and I pulled up the Agency Case Files holiday special. I had just backed that on Kickstarter and read that like a month ago when I got my copy, and I just didn't make the connection that you wrote that short. So I was like, oh yeah, okay, again, already something I like before I even knew this.
Yeah, Colin's great. Colin Craiger, who does the Agency Case Files, another Irish creator who I've collaborated with a lot at this point. So I think I've done like 4 or 5 different short stories with him over the last number of years. We really kind of connected over the course of the pandemic, and he's just an immense talent. Like, you've seen his stuff with the Case Files, this sort of X-Files meets Blade Runner series, and he's just so enthusiastic, you know, so young as well, which is like annoying because he shouldn't be that good at the age he is, but he's there, and he's just improving every time, and he's just a lovely guy and someone who I look forward to working with and look forward to meeting up with at conventions. Like, he's great, and I love his stuff.
Yeah, he does truly great work, and that series is a lot of fun, and it has a lot of depth, I feel like, left to mine through it. So let's start going, talking about your work and just kind of general chit-chat is kind of how we go. But Ashley, I know you had a ton of questions after reading the stuff that Gary sent us over, so I'll let you kind of start us off with some, like, whatever you want to ask first, because I was a little too talkative last episode.
No, it's all good. Yeah, no, I absolutely loved reading the copies of When the Blood Is Dried that you gave us. One of my favorite things about any creative medium, especially comics now, is being able to see all these different cultures in a way that maybe I wouldn't normally throughout my life. And just having like a very kind of like an Irish experience, especially trying to read the names, which you were so kind as to give me a pronunciation guide on Twitter. Thank you very much. Would never have gotten those right. But what I wanted to ask about that was the intention to go in with this more Irish kind of tale. Is there any specific kind of things you're pulling from the culture, or is it just kind of the experience of living there?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for giving me an excuse to talk about the pronunciation guide and to put it up, because it's been something that I've been threatening to do for a while. But you're definitely hitting on exactly one of the things that I wanted to do with the book. So for those who don't know, When the Blood Has Dried is this high fantasy spaghetti western mashup from Mad Cave Studios. Myself, Daniel Romero, Becca Carey, and James B. Emmett on editing put this out through Mad Cave Studios. And the idea was to do a high fantasy book with a uniquely Irish sensibility. So the way I often pitch it to people is that it's Baldur's Gate meets Unforgiven. And the essential part of the story is that it follows this character, Maeve of Clonia, who's a retired adventurer of the Xena or Red Sonja variety, who was once a part of this guild of sellswords and barely managed to escape that life of violence. And when we meet her, she's hiding in a small rural village and has been for a long time. And to speak to what you were saying, Ashley, goes directly to my experiences growing up in those kind of villages, those kind of towns in Ireland. These kind of countryside, lakeside, seaside towns where everyone knows everyone and there's very tight-knit communities. And often in those communities you will have people who come from outside, whether that be someone who's not from Ireland or sometimes it's even someone who's just from the next parish over. And they move into these communities and they're welcome, they're made to feel welcome. But there's always a sense that there's an asterisk to their participation in that community. They're often labelled in these communities as blow-ins. And these are people who could be there for 20, 30, 40 years. But they're always the blow-in. They're never fully part of the community. And it's always a sort of, you know, loving slagging or loving kind of teasing and mockery. But, you know, it's always that kind of underlying sense to it. So Maeve, our main character, very much feels like that in this town, in that she's running the she has for a number of years been running the local tavern. She's taken over from the previous bartender or barkeep who passed away. And she's now become this pillar of the community. And the community looks to her and, you know, respects her and really likes her. But she's always going to be a blow-in. She's never fully part of the community. And that kind of sense or that attitude is something we explore in the book. And really what we were trying to do with the kind of the Irish side of things in When the Blood Has Dried, where one, it's, as you say, it's to kind of give a sense of what it's like, you know, a sense of what it is like living in these rural parts of Ireland, particularly if you're an outsider. And to give you a sense of what those kind of places feel like. But also, there was an intentionality on my part to try to add a counterpoint to a lot of the high fantasy that is very much inspired by the British tradition of high fantasy that goes back to Tolkien and, you know, very much puts on a pedestal certain things about, you know, monarchies or kingdoms and elements of imperialism, to kind of push back on that in one sense. But also within that tradition, there's a habit, now not everyone does it, but there's a habit to sort of co-opt things from Irish culture, such as the Irish language or Irish folklore mythology, and to put that in place of world building. So you have sort of the Irish language shows up as discount Elvish in a lot of different novel series or a lot of different, you know, book series or TV series, things like that. And it's you know, done in place of, you know, one's own world building. And that's something that, you know, when I come across it as a fluent Irish speaker, like, it just pulls me out of the experience. Like, one of the things that I always joke about with people, or like point out to them, is that there's an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer where Giles, they're all in the library, and Giles pulls out this tome and he says, this is clearly, we are dealing with some ancient Gaelic text or ancient Gaelic magic. And he pulls open a page and he starts pointing, like, this is what we're dealing with. And that page is Oscuilge. It's in Gaelic, but it's the bus timetable for Dublin. But it's presented as, you know, this mystical spell. And, you know, that kind of thing just had always pulled me out of the experience. So it was trying to add more authenticity to that and to show that there can be a uniquely Irish spin on high fantasy that, you know, incorporates things like the language, the folklore, and the mythology accurately and in an authentic way, but also gives you a sense of what it's like to live in Ireland. And I think people who would have seen, you know, the Banshees of Inisherin over the last year would have gotten a sense of that too. I'm not sure if that fully answers your question, but I think that was really, that was the kind of the sense or the intent behind it for a lot a a lot of ways.
Absolutely. That answered it perfectly, because it, when I was reading it, it really did feel like this is a genuine place. And so, like, knowing that it's like, oh, it is based on, like, you know, the places you've lived and gone to is just like, well, that's what I love about media creation in general, is getting to learn about these other things.
And the sort of characters that you come across in these places. Like, you know, the, and I mean characters in sort of in the way, like, the kind of people you come across, and, you know, the particular way that they speak, you know, the tone, the cadence they have, how they interact with each other. Like, that's an important part of, you know, what makes any kind of work of fiction feel authentic, is, like, the feeling that, you know, you could encounter these people anywhere, and it wouldn't necessarily have to be, you know, the fantasy setting, you know, that they feel real in some way. So I think grounding in that sense, you know, helped a lot, but it was something that, you know, I wanted to do.
Absolutely.
There's, and I promise, well, I'll keep to first issue only. You blessed us with the first three, which is like a blessing and a curse, because now, since I read the physical issues as they come out, I'm like, oh, I'm gonna have to wait now like an extra couple months before I get to the resolution of that, but I'll likely forget when they come into my box and get surprised all over again. But within the first issue, you establish the world so beautifully, and you establish the main antagonist so well. There is a sense, talking about kind of like it being based in just like how you grew up and things like that, I couldn't help but like notice the distinction of it. Both of the main kind of antagonists in some way are blonde, high elvish men who come in saying like, we will make this town better for you. We will make your lives better. But our main character, the person we're following, knows better, knows that this is a lie. This is this handsome elf's lie. And I'm just wondering, was it your decision to make the elves look like that? Or was it the artist, Daniel's decision, to do that? Like, I'm just curious.
No, that came, the character design, most of that came from Daniel. And one of the things that Daniel is from Chile, and one of the big things that Daniel wanted to do when we were speaking about it was we wanted to make the town and the world, you know, feel diverse. You know, so if you're looking at the townsfolk or anyone who appears in town, like, there's a broad range of kind of backgrounds, you know, ethnicities and things like that, because we were kind of sick of seeing, you know, and I think the argument had been going on Twitter at the time, really, like, oh, why are there black elves in The Witcher? I was like, well, why wouldn't there be? You know, or like, you know, even this week, you know, in the Warhammer community, people are saying, oh, there are female custodians. Like, and the answer is, of course, well, why wouldn't there be? Or like, why is it a big deal? So when Daniel was designing characters, he was trying to look at it from as wide a range as possible. And so to have that in both the characters you see in the town, but also in the main cast. I think for one of like the, per se, like the figureheads of the guild to be kind of, you know, more kind of presented as kind of more highborn or more proper, or seen as proper society, that was something that informed probably both Daniel and my approach to the book. Because I make no qualms about it being kind of, you know, anti-imperialist. So like the kind of language that the guild use, people like Darius and Nikolai who are representatives of the guild, this kind of this paramilitary institution, who present themselves to the world as being this great band of heroic figures who protect the realm, but in reality are nothing more than, you know, glorified mercenaries who get their authority and who get to, you know, get away with a lot of things because they have the stamp of approval from the state behind them. I think that's very intentional. It's very kind of, it's very kind of poking at that these kind of institutions that a lot of people put their support in, these institutions that a lot of people who put a lot of, you know, focus on trying to present themselves as being, you know, forces for good, you know, oftentimes they are tools of oppression by, you know, colonialist powers, imperialistic powers. So that was something we were playing with and engaging with as well. And again, that's part of the, I suppose that's an element of the Irish take on the high fantasy as well, and that it calls into question those things where in more traditional high fantasy or in a lot of the big pillars of the genre or the big tentpole series of the genre would just, you know, say, oh, monarchy, imperialism, we just accept those. You know, those are mm-hmm. those are good things, and what matters isn't that we have a kingdom, but that we have, or that we have an empire, but that it's the right person sitting in the throne or the right person with the crown in their head. And where we kind of, you know, it's not the main focus of it to a large thing. You know, we're not there, you know, on a pulpit complaining about those things, but we're definitely, like, you know, skewering them and presenting them in such a way like we shouldn't always assume that these things are good. And part of what, as you see in the book, the impetus for Maeve trying to get out of this guild is that realization. And realizing, you know, that perhaps being complicit in that, you know, takes a toll. And that's where the unforgiven and the sort of, you know, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in of it all comes into it.
Yeah, that was just a great answer for that. Like, because it's just kind of hard to escape those feelings as you're reading it, but that's just because the world is so well done and fleshed out. One of my other questions was about just side characters, because when I was in college and I was doing my creative writing courses, I had submitted a piece that was a big action piece, and the big criticism I got from it was, hey, this is like good action. We're interested in like the two players in this piece, but they're having this big battle in a downtown of a city. There's no reaction from the city. The city's quiet. The city's dead. Where is the city in this? And your work, you have these characters that kind of just show up with either no name or just like small names, but they add a level of character work to the town that makes it feel fully alive, but at the same time none of the characters fall into common tropes or archetypes. Like, you somehow are able to avoid being like, well, here's your town fool and here's your whatever. Like, you just kind of like avoid these kind of fantasy tropes. So I was just curious, in the writing side of it all, did you already kind of build out the townsfolk? Did you have these characters named, written, all this? Or was it as you're going along, you're like, I need the town to interject here. I need someone to interject here. Let me now develop a side character. How was that when you came to developing the town itself?
So I think you're right. The town itself is, and presenting the town as a character of itself is vital, particularly for the first issue, because ultimately, like a lot of the spaghetti western style stories of this ilk, you know, your Unforgivens, your History of Violences, a lot of it comes to, or, and your Shanes, of course, because Shane, Logan, there's that element of it too. A lot of it comes down to, okay, this person has retired, they're trying to eke out a bit of a peaceful existence, a peaceful life for themselves away from their past. So in order for you to be invested in that and invested in the risk of, you know, having that all crumble and being dragged back into it and losing that bit of peace, you have to care about them and you have to care about the place that they have come to see as home. If you guys don't, as readers and the audience, don't care about the town, don't care about the people in it, then if Maeve is at risk of losing that, then it doesn't really matter. The story doesn't work. So early on in the development process, because Daniel and I had been working on this for a fair number of years away in the background. Daniel is someone who was one of my earliest collaborators in comics when I started self-producing and self-publishing short stories in 2018. We'd started working on stuff very early on then. And when we came upon the idea of When the Bloodhouse Dried, which really came from my initial experiences of tabletop role-playing, one of the things we did, because we were just in a long period of development, which was elongated by the pandemic in one way, but I think it was to our benefit, was that I did up a list of kind of character profiles for Daniel. So before we had, you know, scripted out the first full script, I had, okay, here's what a character profile, a one-page character profile for May, for Fergus, for Nikolai. And then I also put out, and here's other characters in the town we're gonna meet, what their kind of role is. So characters like Queeveen and Beru are there, and their role and their arcs were kind of roughly sketched out. And it was really in the writing then that they became more fleshed out characters, and they became the characters who they are. And you know, they might have smaller roles in some issues and larger roles in other issues, but it was kind of bit what their kind of role in the story was sketched out and what some of their kind of characteristics would be. So Beru is the son of the town's mayor, the town's gaffer, and has that kind of sense of entitlement to him. So that was always there, but how that expressed itself and how everyone kind of reacted to him came out in the actual process of writing.
Actually, I'm gonna give you the floor back now. I know you have more questions.
Yeah, but before I move on to another question, I do want to say that, like, even within just the first issue, once you get to that last page where you can see this, like, Adventurers Guild member come in with this smirk on their face, I'm already deeply invested in this town. I'm already like, oh no, everything that I've seen already that's been amazing is going to be messed up. And that's just amazing. And even through to the stuff we can't talk about in future issues, you do still kind of keep this lighter tone to it that is not something I necessarily expected, especially out of some of the darker scenes. It just feels like it's going to be a bit more gritty than it ended up being. And I was very happy about that. Because in my experience with comics, which I admit is very limited, there's a lot of grittiness. And so it was really refreshing to be like, oh, well, they're just, you know, still being a little silly with it all.
Yeah, no, I fully get what you mean by that. I think that, obviously, in the title, you can kind of expect that we are building up to a bit of that, in a sense. You know, it starts off, you know, with our opening pages is Maeve's past life. Maeve as the adventurer, Maeve as this mercenary who has a lot of blood in her hands. And that's, she still has that red in her ledger when we meet her in the present day side of the stories. And one of the things we enjoy doing, we wanted to do, was to have those kind of, each issue kind of begins with a prologue section that kind of gives you a hint back into how Maeve transitioned from the mercenary to the barkeep. But, you know, with the guild coming into town, with the guild members, you know, presenting an obstacle to that peaceful existence, you know, part of the tension of the story is, well, can Maeve maintain that barkeeper persona? Can she maintain that new part of herself? Or is she going to revert into old habits? And, you know, it's something that we explore in the book itself. And it's a slow burn in that way.
Absolutely can't wait to read more of it. But my next question is, since I am more of a novice, especially how comics are made, I wanted to ask if you could explain what a comic collective is, because I am not 100% sure what that is, and I know you are a part of Limit Break.
Of course. So Limit Break is a comic collective that I founded with Garrett Luby and Paul Carroll back in 2018. And effectively what it is that it's... Well, one thing it isn't is that it's not a publisher, or not a publisher per se. The idea with Limit Break was that Limit Break came about because myself and two of my very best friends in comics and in general... wanted to be able to push each other in our work and in our craft and how we make comics, but and support each other as well. But there's a lot of kind of indie publishers out there, and we didn't want to be, you know, a publishing house. We didn't want to be accepting other people's submissions. Really what we wanted to do was to put out our own books and to have a supporting framework for that. So as a collective, you know, what we primarily do is that when it comes to each other's books, say we exhibit together. So if we're at a convention or at a trade show or at a comics festival, we would exhibit as Limit Break Comics, and we would have, you know, the three founders who were later followed by Seamus Kavanagh as one of our kind of fourth permanent members. So we'd have all of our books along with books from other people who have, you know, worked with us and, you know, wanted to put their stuff under the Limit Break label, as it were. And we will exhibit as a collective, but But if individually one of us is going off to a convention that the others aren't, we would have each other's books and support them. So we have that side of it. But a key part of it is that, you know, if I have a story problem and I'm trying to work out something and I'm just banging the head on the table the entire time, I ring up Paul or I ring up Garrett going, guys, I just can't figure out this element of the story. It's not working. Can I talk it out with you and see if I can come to a solution? And they might have solutions or they might not, or they might, the process of just hearing me out might help me figure it out. But really, we were trying to, in Founding Limbreak, we wanted to push each other in that way, you know, a sense of accountability, so that if I said I was going to do a short story in a month and you know, write the script, publish it, and get an artist to work on it, they would hold me to account, because that's how I first started making comics. I kind of set myself a challenge of putting together a 4-page short story every month. So that was part of it. But also it's the, you know, the rising tide raises all ships of it, where we go to conventions either collectively or individually with the banner of Limit Break behind us. And then there's the support structure, both in terms of our storytelling, but also of each other on a personal level. So it's a very informal kind of thing. It's an informal club.
Yeah. Really. That's very interesting, because I just saw it and I was like, how's that work? And that is amazing. It's just the little club, like you said.
Yeah. Like, we do publish books, you know, we do our annual anthologies where we put out an open call, but that's very much a new thing. It's something we've done in the last 3 or 4 years. And it's something we do to kind of, you know, promote comics in Ireland and Irish creators internationally. But that isn't the raison d'etre. That's not why we didn't get into comics to be doing these big anthologies. These big anthologies happen to be something we do now under the banner, but we aren't there accepting new books every single week. If we're publishing other people's work who aren't normally part of our collective, it's through that process.
All right. I think that answered that question. Jesse, do you have another one?
Yeah. Gary, going back to your overall, just your work that you've put out, reading Where the Blood Is Dried and all of your sample work that you sent us, I kept on getting the sense of you enjoy tension building a lot is the best way to put it. Especially with the 3 issues that you sent us, you really do well with building continuous tension within the issue as things kind of escalate. And then when the next issue starts, you kind of release that tension in good and bad ways. Like, not that the release is all that cathartic, but sometimes it just leads into another tension building moment. But how do you bounce that in your scripts? Or like, is that something you are consciously thinking about all the time with that? That's something I think about sometimes with my work, is where am I building the tension? How am I building it? Where do I release it? So I was just curious, because it felt like in a perfect lockstep pace in those 3 issues that you gave us.
No, you have it on the ball there, that a lot of, particularly for When the Blood Has Dried, is about the unease of the situation that Maeve finds herself in that she has presented herself as one thing to the town, and her past has literally shown up on the doorstep, and now over the course of the series is intruding and imposing itself on this new life. So, you know, she's constantly trying to repress that part of herself and struggling with that prior violence that she was engaged in, and that still lives inside her in some sense. So to be able to express that, and for the reader to be able to feel that, you kind of have to have this tension building in the background. And it's something I love when it's done well in fiction, whether it's comics, novels, TV shows, what have you. I think it comes a lot from, prior to When the Blood Has Dried, I'd spent a lot of time writing crime fiction and crime stories in comics, where a lot of that comes down to, you know, what's the mood of the piece, you know, what's the tension that's underlying every conversation, you know, what's the conversation behind the conversation, and reading between that. And I like exploring that, and I like building it up. And I think a lot of times I think the reason it works so well is because of Daniel's work, both in terms of the line work and the colors, because, you know, he sells that mood, he sells that idea of, you know, a rising temperature in the water as you go along, and, you know, the blood beginning to boil in the room as, you know, people knock against each other and their diverging viewpoints clash. But I think a lot of it is about, you know, pacing and, okay, well, how, when do you know, when do you slow it down? When do you speed it up? And I think a lot of that comes, again, in the process of writing. I do everything longhand first. So I've got notebooks on notebooks in my office, you know, that have, you know, first draft of scripts, outlines in them. And I kind of really break it down if something's not work. And I kind of look at comics in perhaps a strange way, in that I think there's a lot of connection with comics and the likes of music or poetry, in that I think there's a meter to it. And I think you can feel, like in the way that if you're listening to music and someone's off key, you can feel that and you can hear it. I think that also comes across on a comics page. So the reason why I do a lot of it longhand is that I can essentially beat it out. I can really work out the tempo, how this should feel, slow it down if I need to, add a panel, drop a panel, and I can do that more readily longhand because I can scratch it out or add it in, so that when I'm transferring that draft to, you know, a word processor or whatever I'm using, I already have, you know, the core of it there and the pacing of it down, and really then the draft that is transferred into Word is for polish more so than anything else.
That kind of leads into another question I had too about just writing fantasy in general. I know as a reader, when it comes to prose work, I struggle the hardest with fantasy, especially high fantasy, because there's just a level of world building in my mind that I have to do to kind of wrap my head around the world that everybody's building. I remember in high school when I read The Hobbit, it was one of the biggest chores, and I loved reading. It was just like The Hobbit itself. Even though I knew the characters because of the movies and everything, it just wasn't really clicking. And it's the same thing I still struggle to this day, as all my friends are into like Brandon Sanderson and things like that. It's like, I love that for you guys, but as soon as I get a page in, my eyes kind of go cross and I get lost in everything because there's just so much density when it comes to fantasy and building an unfamiliar world. So on the opposite side of writing that, do you find writing comic-wise helps with that kind of getting lost in the weeds of the world building because you have an artist that kind of helps you craft that world? But as you just said, you have a bunch of notebooks. I don't know like where the middle ground is for that. I know from reading it, I do enjoy reading fantasy comics way more than I do enjoy reading fantasy books, because the art helps me get over that hurdle of trying to picture everything.
I think there's something to that, perhaps. I'm someone who grew up reading a lot of, you know, high fantasy stuff. So I was at the right age when the Lord of the Rings films came out. And with that came, you know, a resurgence in popularity of high fantasy. So a lot of, you know, series were reissued or new series were greenlit. So there was a lot of good stuff. There was a lot of crap too. And, you know, you learned quickly to be able to tell the good from the bad. And it ultimately would come down a lot to, you know, character. You know, what series were essentially, you know, someone writing up their D&D notes or writing up, you know, the world that they had set up for their campaign. And what was it actually, you know, a kind of character story at the end of it? You know, what was actually about, you know, what people wanted, you know, why they might be prevented from getting that, and what happens if one or the other occurred. So I think that, you know, for comics, I think to a large extent, the way that, you know, in terms of, you know, shorthand for world building, I think a lot of that world building still is there in comics, you know, or in comics high fantasy. And you've seen recently kind of a resurgence in a lot of high fantasy comics. I think for a while there was kind of a dearth of material. And it seems in the last 12 months, there's just been a renaissance of sorts when it comes to high fantasy comics. But I think a lot of it is that, I think there's a lot of that world building is still there in this book and in other books. I think a lot of the time, say in a novel series, you know, that kind of background material comes out because, you know, that will fill page space or it's something that, you know, characters will talk about, because you can be more wordy in that sense. You can have more, you know, you can have entire chapters that are just back and forths, right? And you can just have, you know, Littlefinger versus Sansa back and forth, or what have you. Whereas you can't really get away with that in comics. You know, you couldn't have an issue that's 20 pages of just tit for tat table tennis. Tell me all about, you know, the legend of, you know, Darius of Ardguin. Tell me about that. Tell me about all those things. And you can't have the 10 pages of Tolkien poetry. Or if you do, you can't do it in a single issue format. You'd have to do it in a collective graphic novel, and kind of, you have to be part of the framework, part of the craft would be to build that in an organic way. So I think in comics you have to be much more aware of the economy of page read estate, each page being a unit of storytelling of itself, while also being part of the issue of the whole and being a part of spreads. And because you have to be economic, which, you know, the words you use, everything has to count. And you don't have the luxury of going off for 5 pages telling the story of Gil-galad. You have to just focus on the task at hand and focus on your characters and make it as character focused as possible. And there can still be all the lore you want. There can still be all the world in there in the background. And you might even publish supplementary material that fleshes that out. Like, if I remember Philip Kennedy Johnson had a book a couple of years ago with Black Label called The Last God. And that was a sprawling high fantasy epic, dark fantasy. And he also had, you know, D&D tie-in material. He had an entire source book that released alongside the series, because there was all this material and all this world building and lore that he wanted people to engage with too. But the day-to-day of the storytelling, the day-to-day of the story was much more succinct. You know, there wasn't those kind of lofty purple prose, pages upon pages of lore. That was for side material, because ultimately that wasn't what people were there for. People were there for the characters and for the story, which is, in that sense, which is really just all about, like, what the characters want and why they should or should not get it.
Yeah, Last Gods is another one of those books where I'm like, man, Philip, you really popped off, huh? Like, you really decided, like, for your first, like, your first big, like, not independent book, but just DC kind of gig outside of writing the main characters. He really went off, like, I'll write even music to this that I scored myself because I could play the trumpet. And I'm like,
Yeah, he's in, like, now, a military band.
Yeah, he is. He's in the military band. And it's just one of those things where, like, even after talking with him, I'm like, man, you just starting off with us other writers have to catch up to you, I guess.
Pretty much, yeah. I think that's the key thing, is like that he knew what to keep on the page and what to reserve for the supplementary material.
Yeah, 100%. He was, and even, like, for me, like, the supplemental material for that, it was one of those things where, like, I kind of glazed over the supplemental material because it was too much information for what I was looking for in fantasy. So, like, yeah, he was really smart about, like, what to keep in and out of that.
Exactly. Sure. Like, like Tolkien has his appendices, and say the people who've read The Lord of the Rings versus the people who've read The Lord of the Rings plus the appendices, you know, those are very different audiences.
Yeah, very much so. My last question that I have written out is it back to kind of like your sprawling career of, like, just different genre work, is there one piece or author in particular that kind of inspired, like, what you go for and how you write your stories? It seems like every story you write has some kind of thriller element to it, no matter what genre it's in. Like, there's always some level of just secrets and suspense in that way, like just the general thriller aspect. But was there anything, one thing that, like, inspired you, like, that's the kind of writing I would like to do? Or is that something that kind of just came as you explored your writing?
I don't know if there's one writer that kind of really encapsulates it. So, like, in terms of, like, you know, creative touchstones, I love, you know, Brubaker and Phillips stuff. Anything those two do, you know, sign me up. You know, I don't care. I will buy it sight unread, you know, sight unseen sort of things, right? And a lot of the, there's a lot of the kind of the thriller in that, of course. Bendis and Bagley on Ultimate Spider-Man was another kind of, you know, seminal piece of work in terms of, you know, my exploration of comics and what it could be and what it could do. I think that a lot of the times when I was first starting to write comics, one of the, as I said to you earlier, I started writing comics in 2018 and I kind of set myself the challenge of writing these four pagers each month, and to do kind of complete short story within the scent of the span of a month and get it produced and put it up online. And the kind of logic for that was that 2000 AD, which is the magazine that publishes Judge Dredd amongst other stories, had open submissions for what they call a future shock. And a future shock is essentially their method of getting new writers and new talent on board. And what it is, it's a four-page sci-fi fantasy horror short story with a twist at the end. And the twistier the better, essentially. And this is something that, you know, writers like Al Ewing, Neil Gaiman, Alan Moore all cut their teeth on, because it's been going on for since the 70s. There's a 50-year tradition of this. So I was kind of trying to practice that format. So the idea of, and in a four-page short story, you have so little space. This is why I emphasize always the importance of, you know, the economy of storytelling in comics and the economy of a page read estate. In a four-page short story, you have two page turns and one spread. And you have to really make each one of those pages and each panel count. So in that time, you've got to set up the conflict, you know, give a bit of character, give action, and then build to something and then have the twist or the tension resolve at the end. So I think having practiced that a lot, it kind of, it is, you know, intruded into other parts of my work. But I think it also comes down to a lot of the things that I like to write. It comes down to, you know, the vibes of a piece in a lot of ways. So like I think, say, for example, whether it's, you know, Brubaker and Phillips or something that Bendis and, say, Oeming work on, you know, there's a certain feel to that. There's a certain vibe to all that work that kind of ties into what I was saying earlier about, you know, trying to really sound out what a page sounds like and make sure that the meter is correct. So I think that to the extent that I'm, that there's this common sense of, you know, tension building up, I think it's because that, say, for a story, for some of my crime stories, or whether it's When the Blood Has Dried, which is, you know, high fantasy spaghetti western, but, you know, ultimately it could be a crime story. Like the central story of Maeve, you know, doesn't need to be in a high fantasy setting. It could be sci-fi, it could be modern day. And the core of the story would remain the same. So I think that's perhaps it. I obviously enjoy writing things with twists and writing things that have, you know, this kind of tension building up and this sense of foreboding and this mood throughout. And this, I think that kind of sense of mood comes from having written a lot of crime fiction from when I started writing comics to when I sat down to write When the Blood Has Dried. And so that kind of pervades a lot of my work. And I think, yeah, I think ultimately you could say that When the Blood Has Dried is just me writing a crime story in a different setting to what I would normally have written.
Actually, I'm going to pass the baton back over to you and see if you have any more questions.
Yeah, I actually have one question that very interested to hear the answer about. So as the show is about kind of learning how to love comics, I was wondering if you had any, yeah, as the show is about learning how to love comics, if somebody after listening to this episode goes and reads When the Blood Has Dried and found that they absolutely love it and want to explore even more, is there anything you know of that you might recommend to somebody?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this for the last while in terms of that, like I said, for ages there had been kind of a gap of high fantasy comics where it had kind of fallen out of vogue, it had fallen out of favor. But there seems to be a lot of, you know, books heading that direction now. And particularly for someone who is, say, maybe more familiar with prose and maybe coming from it from someone who maybe has read a lot of high fantasy novels and things like that, or is a fan of Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon and is looking for things along those lines. and particularly if it's after When the Blood Has Dried. I think there's a couple of things that they can check out. I think that the current Conan the Barbarian series from Titan Comics, with Jim Zub acting as the head writer, with Rob De La Tour and Doug Brightwaite as the ongoing art team at present, I think that is very, very good. I think it goes back to a lot of the literary origins of Conan and works a lot in that sense. And as a procedural fantasy, in the sense that, you know, it's about, you know, established character who the joy or the benefit of it, or the what you get out of the series, is seeing that, you know, immovable character interact in different scenarios. I think that's very good. Things like The Hunger in the Dusk from G. Willow Wilson ties into that. Die, I think, from Kieran Gillen and Stephanie Han, which is this examination of fantasy through the lens of tabletop role-playing games and the people who play them, and really talks about this idea of, if you were, I think Kieran has described it in various interviews and stuff as, you know, did I disappear into the fantasy world at the age of 16? And did I ever actually emerge? So what it kind of talks about, you know, what a lifetime of, you know, consuming that kind of stuff does to you, and, you know, being very introspective on that. I think Die is something that I think a lot of people would enjoy. And as we said earlier on, The Last God as well, for people who are looking for those kind of dark fantasy style books, and one that kind of touches on the same themes that Joe Abercrombie does in his novels, or the likes of some of the more kind of grim dark style fantasy series, I think a lot of those would be of interest.
I cannot wait to check all those out. That was definitely a question for everyone else and not me, who's just gonna wait for issue 4 to come out now.
Oh, definitely not. Of course.
Yeah, I'm not selfish on the show at all.
It's your show. You can be as selfish as you want. I think that's a key. It's your prerogative to be as selfish as you want.
I'll take that into account for the next time we talk.
I lied. I have one more last question now that I remembered it.
Hit me.
How does it? And you've told me while we were chatting, and you mentioned it, I think, before we started recording, but you are a lawyer, and your day job is a lawyer still, right? I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who do you think will win the legal battle, you or Charles Soule, the other comic book writer lawyer?
Well, he's not practicing currently, so automatically.
True. He's out of date.
He's out of date now. He's like, you know, he's a couple of years out of date, and I suppose it depends on what our choice of forum is. So if it's Irish law, I definitely win. If it's US law, I studied over in the US for a while in a law school in Montana, so I might have a chance. But I've actually met Charles. He's really, really sound. He's really, really nice. It's funny how many writers in comics I've learned over the last couple of months, you know, have a legal background of some sort. David Hazan, who writes Nottingham for Madcap as well, is also, or at least was formerly, a lawyer in Australia. But yeah, I think depending on where we actually have the battle, because I think, you know, obviously, you know, hometown, you get hometown advantage. I reckon I could take Charles Soule. I reckon I can take Charles Soule in a legal battle. He would crush me in a physical fight. But
that just makes me hope that one day you get to have your crack at Daredevil too, because I feel like
Don't get me started. Like, that is like dream gig right there.
Yeah, I feel like one of the unsung thing about Charles's run of Daredevil is like the lawyering part of Daredevil was so good during it.
No, your heart's been right. I remember back when because I spent a time writing for various comic sites and comic journals and things like that, and comic periodicals, you know, from a criticism point of view. I did a big article about his Supreme arc, which was when he took the test, where I think it's like, you know, the fourth or the fifth arc in Charles's run is about Matt taking this test case to the Supreme Court. And the thing I was analyzing it was about how accurate was it to, you know, procedure and how you would actually bring a test case, how you would select a test case and get it from the first instance court all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States. And as you can imagine, having been written by a lawyer, it is actually fairly accurate.
It's just... Well, one of those things, now that you said that there's more creators back there that have law backgrounds, it just reiterates something I was talking to a friend about. It's like, if you're going to collect comics like I do and like some of my other friends do, you end up getting into tech in some way because that's the only way you can afford collecting so many comics. And that seems like to start writing comics, you might need to get into being a lawyer in some way.
It's just the creative side of us just screaming out for an avenue when you're going through the day-to-day of lawyering.
Well, Gary, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and talking with us. I'm just, again, so ecstatic about the series, and we'll go into a bit more depth of the full series in one of our regular episodes, I think, that the next one that we're going to record. But the first issue's out right now. Go to your local comic store, go online if you don't have one near you. Digital is always an option too. Pick it up if you can. Let's get it sold out. That would be great. So you can get like a second printing. That would be pretty awesome. Does Mad Cave do second printings? I don't know if I've ever heard of Mad Cave doing second printings, but they should.
Well, let's make this the first one if they have not already.
Yeah, exactly. Let's beat Dick Tracy to the punch. And then
you, Dick Tracy.
Which also, like, I hope they're going to give you... It seems like they're reviving a lot of the pulp stuff, because they just announced they're doing a Flash Gordon book, I think.
Yep, they're doing a Flash Gordon book over there.
So they need to hand you over one of those pulp characters if they're going to keep grabbing those. Let's see you on, like, the Spirit or something like that, I would hope.
Do not tempt me on the Spirit. I would write the Spirit in a heartbeat.
Gary, when's FOC of the next issue? Do you know off the top of your head?
So FOC for issue 2 has passed, but it's coming out. Issue 2 will be out on the 15th of May, with issue 3 on the 19th of June. But even though it's passed FOC, like, I would always encourage people to still put in their orders, because their shops will more than likely still be able to get stuff. And that's the easiest way to communicate to them and communicate to Mad Cave and to the world at large, you know, that they're interested in the book and they'd like to see more of it. Because, you know, there's like, you know, this is very much, it's 5 issues, it's self-contained, it had its beginning, middle and end. You know, it's not setting up a sequel per se, but like, obviously if people enjoyed it and enjoy the world, there are other corners of this world we could explore from that kind of very grounded character focused approach to fantasy.
100%. I would love
newbie to spend comics question.
Yes,
go FOC ahead.
Final order cutoff.
Okay.
So it's the last day that the shops can put in their orders ahead of time. And so the publisher's print run will be reflective of that in some way, based on what orders they get. So that's why it's always important, particularly if you're buying from your local comic shop, that you let them know ahead of time so that they can adjust their orders to include you, and particularly for indie books like this, and from, say, two creators, myself and Daniel, Becca, who is our letterer, is very, very well known and very prolific. But for myself and Daniel, this is our first book with a major publisher. So the best way you can tell, the shops won't be as familiar with us as they would be with other creators. So the best way you can support newer creators like us and publishers like Mad Cave, who are willing to, you know, take a bet on newer creators like us, is to pre-order with your local comic shop and to let them know that you want it on your pull list, and that'll make sure that that order is reflected in the FOC demo.
Awesome.
Gary, where can people follow you on internet so they can keep up with updates of the book?
Yeah, so I'm on most of the social media platforms. I'm on Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram. If you search for Gary Maloney, you'll usually find me on all of those. I'm the one that comes up. Or you can go to limitbreakcomics.com, which is the central hub for the collective we discussed earlier. And you can find links to my socials and some of my self-published books there.
And is there any other books that are coming out right now that you like to recommend to people listening?
Okay, other books that are coming out right now. Oh, yeah. So, like, obviously, what ones did I read recently? I read last week The Principles of Necromancy, which is it's the Magma Comics, the new one.
Yeah.
Came out with The Hive Mind. And that's very much a kind of a dark fantasy style book that I really, really enjoyed, and it's kind of offering, it's the first book from Magma Comics as well, and it's just like, it's very much a statement piece, more so than anything else, as to what they want to do, the kind of stories they think you can tell, and it's this kind of dark fantasy world where there isn't magic except for like death magic, and it's really cool. I think it's one that, if you like what the Hive Mind have been doing in being Jackson Kelly, is it Colin Kelly and Jackson
Lansing?
Lansing, I can't remember top of my head. It's too late at this point in the day. But yeah, it's very much, if you like what they've been doing in kind of the big two and Star Trek, I think this is their first creator run book in a long time. So it's worth taking a shot on. Other than that, I read a sneak peek of Space Ghost from David Pepos, and I really, really love that book. I think that's obviously the Hanna-Barbera cartoon, and a kind of a reboot of that, and a retelling of that with kind of modern superhero storying sensibilities. And as someone who kind of loves those pulp adventure heroes, Flash Gordon, the Phantom, it's very much kind of taking that approach to sci-fi and to sci-fi superheroics, with an amazing art team, and with with 12 issues guaranteed. Like, I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, what that team can do with that runway.
Yeah.
And exploring the kind of different facets of that world. Like, I can see that'll be a book that I think a lot of people are going to be drawn to over the next while. So those are two books I read recently that are kind of on the stands either now or will soon be on the stands, that I think are worth your time. And Mugshots as well, from Mad Cave by Jordan Thompson. That's a kind of moody crime book in the vein of Darwin Cooks Parker. And I think that's one that will really surprise people when it comes out.
Just one real quick, and I promise I won't dwell on too long. The Principles of Necromancy with Iman Winklesart on it too is just kind of chilling. I've read Jackson and Colin's work for forever, and have them come out with such a dark and gory book, and then with that art, it was just, I was like, oh, you guys got that dog still in you, don't you? Like,
I think that artist as well was mainly a cover artist until doing interiors, really. For I think this might be that the Principle of the Necromancy might be one of their first longer pieces of interior work, which is phenomenal and a phenomenal achievement.
Ashley, I'm gonna get tossed to you now. Where can people find you everywhere?
You can find me just about on any social media at this point. Mrs. Ashley, M-I-S-S-U-S Ashley. You can also find all of the links to all of that on my website, mrsashley.gay, spelled the exact same way. Been doing a lot of Twitch streams recently, as of the recording of this. I don't, who knows when you're hearing it, but if I've stopped, but I've been doing that as well. So if you want to follow me talking randomly about comics on that from time to time, that would be the place to do it. Where can people find you, Jesse?
Yeah, people can find me most places at Sleeper of the Bed. I post a lot of things about movies, comics, and writing. And if you are not tired of hearing my voice and you like to hear me talk about movies, I do have another show with my friend Matthew called Free Reeling It, where we literally just randomly go through movies, try to be bi-weekly. This episode won't be out for a while, but we just recorded an episode about Charade last night. And it might be the most fun we've had talking about a movie in a minute, because that movie is endlessly charming. You can also follow this show on Twitter at CB Tour Guide, and you can email us if you want to be a guest, have any questions or recommendations for future episodes or anything like that, at ycomicspodcast@gmail.com. And the logo for the show is done by our friend Roma, who you can find at on Twitter as at I appreciate your butt. That will all be in the show notes. Everybody's socials, all the links, all that will be in the show notes for this episode. But yeah, thank you again, Gary, so much for being on and talking with us. I'm so glad you decided to come on and talk about us after you heard David's episode.
No, I really, really thank you so much for having me, and it's been great. It's really, really fun.
And remember, everybody, just keep reading comics. That's all we ask of you.